Are you interested in an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price? Well, we have got the service for you. Casper.com. Get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/filmcast and using promo code filmcast. That's $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/filmcast and using promo code filmcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Slash Filmcast, the official podcast of SlashFilm.com. I'm David Chen, and with me is...
Jeff Cannata.
And it's just the two of us, Jeff. We're missing Devendra Hardwar.
I feel bad. Devendra was so excited about reviewing this movie.
Devendra is the most excited of all of us to see and review X-Men Apocalypse. But unfortunately, he is in transit, could not join us today. And we really wanted to get a review out of one of the biggest blockbuster films of the summer, in time for Memorial Day weekend. So here we are today. Not only that, we just saw the film because I missed my screening. It was during the day. It was 10 a.m. And I have a full-time job. How about you?
I missed my screening because I was in North Carolina.
Nice. So both of us missed our screenings. So we went to go see the movie on Thursday night, first showing. How full was your theater, Jeff?
It was packed.
Oh, wow.
Jam-packed. Yours was not?
About 100 people in my theater.
Really? Mine was completely packed.
Yeah. So we just came from seeing it. We're sitting down now to review the film on the Slash Filmcast. Find more episodes of this podcast at slashfilmcast.com. You can also email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. So let's get right into it, Jeff. Here's our review of X-Men Apocalypse.
I saw the end of the world. I could feel all this death.
Jean, it was just a dream.
You wander through the willows in the forest you have found.
I've been called many things over many lifetimes.
Trying to hide.
Ra, Krishna, Yahweh.
Ever since the world found out about mutants, there have been secret societies who see them as some kind of second coming or sign of God. They believe that tens of thousands of years ago, an ancient being was born, the world's first
mutant.
You are all my children, and you're lost because you follow blind leaders. But I am here now. I'm here for you.
That was from the trailer of X-Men Apocalypse. It's out in theaters right now. I'm going to read the plot summary from IMDb. With the emergence of the world's first mutant, Apocalypse, the X-Men must unite to defeat his extinction-level plan. This film was directed by Bryan Singer, and it was written by Simon Kinberg, who's written a bunch of X-Men films and done a bunch of work with Bryan Singer before. And it stars the younger X-Men, James McAvoy, Michael Fassbender, Jennifer Lawrence, Nicholas Holt, and Oscar Isaac as the villain Apocalypse in this movie.
Yeah, so, none of those pesky old X-Men muddying things up.
Agreed. So, Jeff Cannata, there have been so many X-Men films over the course of the last decade. There's been a very wide spectrum in terms of the quality of these films.
Yes, this movie even comments on that.
That's right. On the one end, you have films like X3 and you have X-Men Origins Wolverine, which are pretty bad. And then on the other end, you see these movies transcending what the comic book genre can do in movies like X2 and even X-Men Days of Future Past is a movie I really enjoyed. So it's been quite a while since X-Men, the first film, came out in 2000. And so my first question to you tonight, Jeff, is on what end of the spectrum do you think X-Men Apocalypse falls on? Is it one of the best films that feature the X-Men, or is it one of the worst?
Well, I'll tell you, Dave, I had heard very bad things about this going in. Obviously, I hadn't seen any of the trailers, hadn't seen any firsthand accounts. But people that I know that didn't miss their screenings like you and I, I had heard pretty negative reports.
They were very vicious, yeah.
Yes. I think I went in with very low expectations.
As did I.
And I had a really good time. I thought it was on the upper end of the spectrum of X-Men movies.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Yeah, and it's interesting that you frame it that way with the number of X-Men movies, because we are in full retcon mode now. It is so much an homage to the comics that we've now progressed to the point where, just like the comics, continuity is the enemy. And we are retconning left and right. I'm not sure which movies are canon and which aren't. Things don't seem to make any sense. Which timeline are we on? I don't know. All these characters are being reintroduced.
My understanding of it is that X-Men Days of Future Past basically reset the timeline.
Right.
So that essentially...
Well, actually, no.
X-Men First Class reset the timeline. And then X-Men Days of Future Past, like, steered it into a new
Kind of, mostly, but not. Yeah, it's a little muddy, you know, just like the comics. So very much in keeping with the X universe in the comics, is continuity is a bitch, and it people kind of ignore things conveniently when they need to, and that's fine. But this movie, in a lot of ways, it's very consciously, it beats you over the head with the fact that we are in the 80s. We are in the 80s now. Just like the 80s, this movie feels like a mixtape of sort of the greatest hits of the X-Men.
It is relentless about those 80s styles, like, to the point of distraction, I would argue.
Oh, 100% agree. Yeah. I mean, it is so on the nose of, like, hey, remember the 80s? You know, Nightcrawler is wearing Michael Jackson's jacket.
Yeah, for most of the film.
Yeah. and that's not even the worst part. I mean, there's somebody plays Pac-Man in the movie.
Jean Grey's outfit throughout most of the film is very 80s-esque.
Oh, all the characters' outfits are 80s-esque. But I mean, it's like the most on-the-nose 80s references. You get Pac-Man, you get Knight Rider, you know, on the television. You get, you know, it's like, you know, we get... I don't even want to spoil it. Yeah. There's a movie that they go to that's, you know, definitive right. 80s movie. It is very on the nose in the 80s. But I bring that up to say that this movie feels like a mixtape that somebody might make me in the 80s of, like, the greatest hits of all the X-Men movies. And I think my biggest – well, not my biggest complaint, but a significant complaint for this movie is that it really feels like all those greatest hits played back again. You know, we get all these characters that we've seen in the movies before doing pretty much the same stuff, and the revelations about them are pretty much the same. And, you know, but it's all played in a kind of new, unique way, and it comes together in its own version of all that stuff. But there's nothing particularly revelatory about it. It's like, oh yeah, we know how all these characters are related to each other and what their powers are, and even surprising powers aren't surprising because we've seen them in other movies happen pretty much this way before. And it's strange that, you know, all these weird origin stories that we sort of need to get again, like, why do we need to get this again? This is not a reboot. This is more of like a retconning. It's very odd. And yet I kind of also feel, as a Marvel zombie from way back, that it's a little sad to me that I have the magic of just seeing these characters come to life in a authentic a way that respects the comics is no longer magical. You know, that's not enough anymore. And it's kind of sad to me, because the first X-Men movie, it was just amazing that it was happening and that these characters were actually on screen. And now we get, like, a Scott Summers who has his own origin story, and his brother's there, and, you know, Havoc, and, you know, we get all these characters that I've never really seen on screen before. You know,
At this stage in their development, yeah.
Right, and even new characters, you know, and fun characters that were kind of messed up in other movies are done better here. You know, it's like – and yet that's just kind of not enough. Like, I do think this movie is pretty decent. And maybe, again, because I had low expectations, I had a good time with it. I didn't think there was anything particularly bad compared with a lot of X-Men movies. But I also didn't think it was particularly special.
Hmm. So my answer to the question of where on the X-Men spectrum this movie falls is right down the middle. I don't think it was one of the worst X-Men movies, although it had several of the characteristics of some of the worst X-Men movies, namely how bloated it was and how much it tries to do. But there are moments of wonder in this film as well,
yeah,
for me, you know, and there are some decent action scenes.
You're right about that bloated point, though. It's way too long.
It's too long, and it tries to do too much, and they just cram all these characters in there. And as a result, some of the characters feel just completely wasted. I will say that the trailer indicates that Olivia Munn playing Psylocke is going to be in the film. And is it Psylocke or Psylocke?
It's Psylocke.
Psylocke, apologies. And
there is an E at the end because it's the British spelling. But
there you go. And I just think she is completely wasted in this film. I mean, given so little to do, and that was a huge letdown because, you know, she's a relatively big star in the film world at this point. And
a really cool X-Men character.
Yeah,
we learned nothing about her.
I love the design of her in this movie, and the special effects around her in this movie were pretty good. And so, you know, that's just one example of some of the problems playing this film, is that you have characters who are introduced and given nothing to do, and then they fight a little bit, and then they go away somehow. And that describes a lot of characters in the movie, unfortunately. I mentioned special effects just a few moments ago, and I would say that some of the special effects in this film are embarrassingly bad. I don't know if you experienced this as well. There's some great special effects, a couple scenes that I thought, wow, that's impressive, and then a lot of scenes that it just looked unfinished. What did you think?
I agree. There are a couple of shots in particular that looked really laughably
bad. Really horrible, like, you know, X-Men Origins Wolverine kind of level of bad in terms of special effects.
Yeah.
And I don't know what caused that. You know, I don't know if it was like a rush to get this out. I don't know if it was the talent of the people working on the special effects. We just have no idea what set of circumstances led to this output. But, you know, a lot of these movies use multiple special effects houses. And so some scenes look awesome and some scenes look terrible. And
I think that situation always comes down to time and money.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really sad, too, because it does detract from the overall impact of the film. I would say the opening scene, the special effects are awful, distractingly bad. And you can't focus on what's actually happening because for me, I just couldn't believe a single thing that was on screen. It just looked like everything was in a computer. The blend between, you know, live action and CG was just very poorly done. And that describes many, many scenes in the film. So a lot of problems there. I'm going to take a little side detour here, Jeff Cannata, and ask you if, you know, this. We actually usually go to press screenings very often, so we don't see movies with Gen Pop.
Yeah,
that often. And one of the things that I noticed when I saw this movie at opening night is there's apparently this trend now where people try to make you feel good about going to the movies. And what I mean by that is, I don't know about you, but before my film played, there was a message from the actress who played Storm in this film saying, hey, thanks so much for coming out to see the movie. We worked really hard on it. Alexandra Shipp is the actress.
Yeah.
And apparently with The Jungle Book, they did the same thing with Jon Favreau. And then after the movie, there's a stinger after the film, which we'll talk about in spoilers. But after the movie, this card flashed on the screen that said something like, this movie was the result of 15,000 man hours of work and hundreds of jobs resulted from this movie. And these kind of subliminal and not so subliminal messages trying to make you feel good about going to the theater. Did you experience this at your theater as well?
Yeah. All those things that you mentioned, I don't know. You kind of bring it up, I think, and it sounds like you feel like there's a sinister overtones here.
No, not at all. We're in a situation now where it's getting harder and harder to get people to turn out to the movie theater. And one of the tactics they're trying is, hey, let's actually just flat out thank people for going to the movies.
Which, I think that's of all the tactics they could employ, I think that's the best one.
Yeah.
I think it's nice. It feels a little heartfelt and human, you know?
I think so as well. I think they could do more. Like, you know, I wonder if they could do more in terms of like kind of special features kind of thing, you know? Mm. I wonder if there's some potential for, you know, like imagine, you know, like HBO, when you watch Game of Thrones, they have this inside the episode thing.
Yeah.
After the show. And I wonder if there's a world in the future where after the credits roll, there's this kind of, you know, inside the episode document or inside the movie documentary or something, kind of bonus features, you know, like the director getting out and thanking me for going to the theater. I don't really feel like that. That is not a draw for me. I'm not going to say, oh, I need to go see Star Trek Beyond so Justin Lin can thank me. I can't just wait for it to come on video on demand, you know?
No, but I don't think it's quite as overt as you're making it as far as like, well, here's a way we can get people to come to the theater. I think it's more about – maybe I'm a rube, but I feel like it's more genuine than that. I feel like it is actually about showing appreciation to the audience and having a little positivity you know, injected into the experience can't hurt. I don't know if it's – I don't think they view it as a genuine tactic to get you in seats.
Hmm. Yeah.
But maybe I'm wrong.
I guess what I'm saying is maybe they should, you know? Like maybe they should start thinking about that.
Well, if you have a movie that is 2.5 hours like this one, I don't think, you know, having more content at the end is going to help anybody make more money.
We mentioned – yeah, good point, Jeff. We mentioned, you know, some of the new characters being given short shrift in this film. Let's talk about some of the returning characters. I mean, what did you think of actors like James McAvoy, Jennifer Lawrence, and Michael Fassbender playing characters that we've come to know them as in the past few years?
It's funny because I think I mentioned this when we reviewed Days of Future Past. Is it's interesting how in the cinematic universe of the X-Men – Mystique has become a major character. Mm-hmm. And I think that really is because they lucked out and managed to cast Jennifer Lawrence when she was on her way up. And she has become this massive movie star. And by virtue of her star power, I think that just elevated that character because they wanted to elevate that actor's presence in the cinematic universe.
And Mystique is not a major character in the comics?
No, not really. I mean, from time to time, she's important. But, you know, in this movie, she's played as like this icon of the mutant movement, you know, and she's the biggest badass of the group. And she's going to be the one that will train everybody. And she's the one that, you know, it just seems like, she, you know, she can take care of business. And it's like, well, she's just a shapeshifter. It's not like, she, you know, I don't know. It's
a shapeshifter who knows martial arts, Jeffrey.
I guess.
It's also interesting, I guess, you know, when I'm thinking about what the behind-the-scenes negotiations of this movie must have been like, if you are a major Hollywood actor like Jennifer Lawrence and you have $100 million in the bank, you probably don't want to sit in a chair or a table for 6 hours getting blue makeup applied to you.
Well, they go to great lengths to explain why she's not in blue makeup most of the movie.
Yeah, she's not in blue makeup most of the movie. She appears in kind of human form for most of the film, and they actually have a story point justifying it, which I thought was pretty funny. But it's kind of an interesting way that real life business deal making, I feel like, must have informed the film to some degree.
Right.
So that's fascinating to see. But yeah, I mean, I think she does a good job. She probably has one of the best roles in this film in particular.
Yeah, I agree. I actually think everybody does a good job, and it's certainly well cast across the board. I think there's a lot of really solid actors here, and even the new additions. You know, Oscar Isaac is to chew scenery throughout, but you know he delivers what is asked of him, and you know I think that character of the villain. You know, the X-Men movies and even the comics to a certain extent are really about the inner personal relations of the team, and you know the heroes and villains are always a sort of a blurry line, and so an actual out and out villain is probably the least interesting player in that whole drama. So such is the case here. I think that Apocalypse is sort of not very well defined. We're not really clear on what his intentions are. He kind of wants to just, because his name's Apocalypse, he wants to create an apocalypse, I guess. I guess he wants to destroy
the
world.
Some men just want to watch the world burn, Jeff.
Yeah, or in this case, float around as little particles in the air.
Yeah.
There's not much burning as much as it's particles floating hither and yon. Yeah.
I think that there is some cool – you know, one of the things about this movie is it does a lot of really cool things. It introduces a lot of really cool concepts. And it doesn't pay off a lot of them, unfortunately. Some of the stuff around Apocalypse is actually pretty interesting. The idea that he might have inspired the Bible's Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, I thought was pretty clever. And the way it depicts his abilities as merging people with the matter around them, I just found to be very, very troubling and inherently terrifying. Right.
Well, yeah, and I think the central idea behind him is that he's got all these abilities because he started out as one guy,
right,
and he keeps getting additive.
He keeps transferring to new bodies, and yeah, for some reason, when he gets into the new body, he retains the ability from the old body.
Right. His actual mutant name should be Feature Creep. That would be the coolest mutant name, Feature Creep.
The way they handle Apocalypse, I think, is very bad. Like, overall, they introduce some cool concepts. Some of the special effects with him are pretty interesting and terrifying. But overall, the way they handle him is pretty bad. Like you said, Jeff, his intentions aren't super clear. They bury Oscar Isaac underneath all this makeup. So what is even the point of getting Oscar Isaac in the first place? You know, that could have been anyone under there. Right?
It really could have, yeah.
And so it's a decent performance, but he's not given that much material to work with. And I think, you know, the stakes are a bit too high. You know, we often complain about the stakes not being high enough. I think the stakes are too high. You know, when you have
– yeah,
it's we've talked about Beam in Sky many times.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a classic Beam in Sky situation where, hey, there's some kind of Beam in Sky, or if you have a situation where there's large beams of stuff or light in the air and the superheroes and supervillains are having some big confrontation in the remains of a city. That has just been done before, you know?
Yeah.
And it's been done poorly and it's been done well, and we've seen it done several times already. And I don't think it adds really anything new.
I think you kind of paint yourself into a corner, however, when you're the main title of your film and the main villain's name is Apocalypse. You know, you kind of, it's the Chekhov's gun of titles. You know,
you're gonna Chekhov's call Apocalypse.
It's, yep, Chekhov's Apocalypse. Yeah, I mean, if you're calling your movie Apocalypse, I guess there's a pressure to make it feel like the stakes are the end of the world.
Right. So just stay tuned for the next X-Men film, X-Men End of Universe.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, what you're saying, Jeff, is they painted themselves into a corner when they chose to tell this particular story.
Right.
Yes. It's difficult to do a movie where the stakes are the end of the world and make it feel grounded enough to have an emotional impact.
And to be honest with you, the Apocalypse is the least interesting part of this movie. And really, all he is there to do is be a MacGuffin to bring the characters we really care about together again and bounce them off of each other, right? His threat is sort of ancillary to what's really going on, which is like, is Magneto going to be good or bad again?
Right.
You know, are the X-Men going to reunite? Is there, you know, is Charles Xavier going to be just a professor, or is he going to create a team of superheroes? You know, those are the questions that we want answered. And the reason that we have to get them answered is because there's this nebulous threat that's sort of happening. And I think the best of these kinds of movies aren't the central MacGuffin to get our characters to jump into action is more interesting and more central to the themes of the movie itself.
Yeah, I mean, just
it's a tough thing to do.
The whole world-destroying threat is very difficult to pull off well, because you have a situation that is inherently going to involve a crap ton of CG that is probably going to look obviously CG, where thousands of people are going to get killed. Think of, you know, the what is it, the world builder in Man of Steel, you know, where all these thousands of people are dying, and you just don't, it's hard to really care about what is actually going on when the stakes are this big and you have a villain this vague and you have all this special effects stuff floating around that you know isn't real. You compare this to like the ending of Civil War, which I'm not going to say what it is, but I will say it's not an end of the world scenario.
But
you know,
the difference the difference in those movies is what are the Avengers? The Avengers are a guy who can shoot laser beams out of his metal suit. You know, a dude who has a shield and it can jump around and punch people. A dude with a hammer who can punch people. You know, these are not yes, we've got the Vision now, and we've got, you know, characters that are a little more powerful. Scarlet Witch is a little more powerful in the Avengers universe. But you contrast that with characters who, the moment you start talking through the ramifications of their powers,
right,
they're gods. And it feels like, well, there really would not be any way to stop that. Like the implication of a Magneto or a Professor X or a Jean Grey is like the hoops you have to jump through to not have it scale up to that kind of insanity,
right,
is difficult.
Yeah, I agree. And it's challenging to sustain that over the course of many films. And I think what we see here is that we've reached the limits of that in some ways.
Right.
I'm very curious how they're going to continue this series if they do so. But there certainly are plans for other movies in the X-Men universe. We'll talk a little bit about that in a bit. But, you know, Jeff, you were talking about nebulous threats. And nebulous threats like Apocalypse on the other side of the world threatening to kill you. And you know what they say about nebulous threats, Jeff? Can make it difficult to get a good night's sleep.
Oh, gosh. That's the worst problem about nebulous threats is the sleep you lose.
Agreed.
Because of how nebulous they are.
You wake up a zombie because of this vague thing hanging over you.
Sense of foreboding all the time. You know what you need for foreboding?
What do you need?
Forbidding.
Oh, that's...
And by four, I mean excellent. Excellent, I mean inexpensive. And by inexpensive, I mean easily accessible on the internet. Am I right, Dave Chen?
That's right. By the transitive property, you're correct. Casper Mattresses, guys. Casper is an online retailer of premium mattresses for the fraction of the price you'd get a normal mattress for. And one of the ways they do that is by delivering the mattress straight to you at your home. And it comes in a really convenient box that you just cut it open and then the mattress unfolds before you and boom, you have a high quality mattress that provides resilience and long lasting supportive comfort. But, you know, Jeff, you pointed out one of the best parts of Casper mattresses. They can often cost well over $1,500, but Casper mattresses are $500 for a twin size mattress. Or $950 for a king size mattress. That
is a fraction of the cost.
Pretty cheap price, Jeffrey Cannata. Yeah. Pretty cheap. Not only that, Jeff, let's say you buy the mattress, you lug this thing into your house.
Well, the real thing you want to do is you want to make sure you've made the right choice. You don't want to walk into a mattress store and lay on a mattress for 2 minutes and decide to spend thousands of dollars. That's what people do. That's what people have been doing for decades, how they've been buying mattresses. They've been waiting for President's Day or Memorial Day like we're having now for these mattress sales. They walk in, they're pressured by a salesman, they lie on a mattress for 2 minutes, and then they have to go home and have that mattress for the rest of their lives?
Yeah, seriously. So it can just be difficult to make a decision like that. But assuming you get the Casper mattress and you're not a huge fan of it, you can return it risk-free. You can sleep on it for 100 days. And the delivery and return is incredibly painless. So,
You don't have to package it up. They'll come and pick it up. It's completely free. 100 days, that's pretty awesome.
There's no reason not to get a Casper mattress by going to casper.com/filmcast and using promo code filmcast, because if you do what I just said, you get $50 off your mattress purchase. And
just by using our promo code?
Yeah, seriously, it's that easy. Get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/filmcast and using promo code filmcast. That's all you got to do to get $50 off an already low price mattress. You know that when it comes time to buy a new mattress, that's kind of when you need to decide what your podcast loyalty is. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that is the time when it is now an emotionally fraught decision.
There are a few times when you're starting a new website.
Yeah, when you're starting a new website, when you need to buy stamps. that's when the rubber hits the road in terms of which podcast you really enjoy. We hope that when you buy a mattress, you'll go to casper.com/filmcast. And use promo code FilmCast because Casper is a big supporter of us. And if you support them, you're supporting us too. So thanks to Casper for sponsoring this episode. Let's get to spoilers for X-Men Apocalypse starting right now.
Now you're looking for the secret.
You're going to see this coming?
No.
But you won't find it because, of course,
you're not going to see this coming.
You're not really looking.
I have been puzzling over how it works.
You don't really want to work it out.
Who's in the box?
I have been dying to tell you.
I want to tell you my secret.
You want to be fooled.
All right, so a bunch of things to talk about. Jeff, let's talk about the stinger at the end of the film.
Okay.
Very last scene. So after the credits roll, we see some men in black, some men dressed in suits, walk in to the place where Wolverine was held, and they vacuum up all the bullets, and they're collecting things, and someone collects the Weapon X blood from Wolverine and puts it in a suitcase. The suitcase closes, and we have an ultra close-up of the term Essex Corp, ominously.
Mm-hmm.
So what is Essex Corp, Jeffrey?
Well, it's a reference to Mr. Sinister, who is a big big X-Men villain that's tied a little bit loosely to Apocalypse. But he's responsible for a lot of stuff. He's a geneticist, and having Wolverine's blood would be a bad thing. He's the guy that cloned Wolverine into a lady and made X-23. One of my favorite X-Men stories of all time when I was a kid, it's one of the stories that I love the most, was the Mutant Massacre, and he was sort of at the heart of the Mutant Massacre. This is the story that actually turned Angel into Archangel, which we kind of see happen in this movie too. And all kinds of other crazy stuff happened in that. And when I read that as a kid, I was like, oh my gosh, comics can do anything, because it was just so daring and so crazy. So who knows what story that they're going toward, but if this is pointing to the Wolverine movie rather than the next X-Men movie, I suspect it might be more to do with X-23. But he's also the guy, and this gets a little convoluted and crazy, but when Scott Summers first married who he thought was Jean Grey, it was actually a clone of Jean Grey named Madeline Pryor. Jean Grey died in comics, and then she came back mysteriously, and Scott was like, sweet, it's the chick I was in love with, and he married her. Well, it turned out that Jean was actually still at the bottom of the ocean, enwrapped, being protected by the Phoenix Force, and Madeline Pryor was just a clone of Jean Grey created by Mr. Sinister, so that she and Scott would bone down and have a baby that he believed would be the most powerful mutant ever.
I have a feeling they're not going to cover all that in the movies. But
well, that's – you know, I don't think so either.
A lot of speculation that there's going to be the female Wolverine though in the next
– Yeah, I think that's probably what it's hinting at. Not at all those other crazy storylines, but the X-23 storyline, because, you know – nothing Hollywood likes better than casting a young up-and-coming actress and giving Wolverine a little sidekick that can spin off into her own movies when old Hugh Jackman doesn't want to play Wolverine anymore.
Yeah, and I think he has said the next Wolverine film will be his last one.
Yeah, then you get your X-23 going. Now you have a Snicked will live on because she can snicked up. She only has two claws, not three, but, you know, she does her best.
Were you surprised when Wolverine showed up? I don't think had you heard before through the grapevine that he's going to be here?
I hadn't heard before, but as soon as they were there and there was a thing and there was noises in it, it was pretty obvious what was going to happen there.
Did your audience go wild?
Yes. There was a lot of cheering in my audience, actually. Nice. The guy directly behind me went apeshit when Jean Grey went full Phoenix. Like standing up in his chair and whooping and hollering and going, yes, yes. It was, I was embarrassed for
but,
him.
But, you know, that's something great that bothered me because, you know, wasn't she supposed to die and then come back?
What?
Like as the Phoenix? Whereas in this movie, she kind of unleashes her powers and becomes the Phoenix.
Well, she's always got the Phoenix Force sort of hidden underneath the surface there.
I see. So there's inconsistency with her unleashing her power at the end.
It's consistently inconsistent.
All right. Fair enough. But speaking of that Jean Grey scene, you know, the thing that really irritated me a little bit is we were talking about stakes and how difficult they are to juggle. And when you have this character who has indeterminate, undefined powers, this guy can reshape matter, right? That's right. What we've seen he can do. He can increase people's abilities.
I think that's his main talent, is that he's the sort of power amplifier guy.
But he can also freaking rearrange matter, Jeffrey. Okay,
that's true too.
That's pretty.
And he seems to have lots of other abilities. He even comments on how he's got all these crazy talents or whatever he says. And at the end he has like a sphere of energy around him for some reason.
He can teleport. That's another thing he can do.
Yeah.
Anyway, he can do all this crazy stuff, and then so it's hard to find a way to defeat him. And it turns out, Jeff, that the way to defeat him is you just have to tell Jean Grey to go do it. That is,
yeah, you got to, because she's the most powerful mutant on the planet, bro.
You could make an argument that, oh, hey, Magneto and Storm and Cyclops, they all helped a little bit, but really, it was Jean Grey. Jean Grey theoretically could have just taken that dude out.
But didn't we see that a couple of times before? Like, hasn't Jean Grey been the key to?
In X3, right?
Yeah.
Also, end of X2, theoretically, as well.
Yeah.
But,
I mean, I thought it was cool. I didn't – it's just like – like I said, it felt like a greatest hits album. It's like, oh, yeah, okay, well, that's how
– Yeah, like Cerebro and Jean Grey killing a lot of things and, you know.
Man, the movies have such a hard-on for Cerebro. I never remember in the comics Cerebro being such a big deal. But Jesus, every goddamn movie we got to spend an hour in Cerebro talking about how great Cerebro is. It really is annoying to me how much Cerebro is in the movies.
You don't think it's an effective plot device, Jeffrey?
I guess. I guess it makes sense that if you can connect your brain to every brain on the planet, it's got to be a plot point in every movie. But enough already with the Cerebro. How many times do we need to see him in Cerebro going, oh, no, I you know, it's like it's that's what I mean. Like everything in its component.
So Cerebro has caused way more problems than it has solved,
yes!
I think, at this point.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, need we remind you, in X2, I think Cerebro is almost used to kill everyone on the planet, right?
But still still use that Cerebro because they're like, you know, jacking into people.
But this is a pre-X2 timeline, Jeff, so they don't know how dangerous it is yet. So at least
that's a good point.
It's somewhat plausible why they would still be using Cerebro.
Very good point.
So what else to talk about in this movie? Quicksilver.
I mean, there's so many things.
Quicksilver.
Oh, yeah. He gets another showpiece. It's like there's like a, you know, like again, there's got to – you got to have – it's a concert where you got to have the right songs. And the Quicksilver song is like the drummer getting a solo at the concert.
That's exactly right. It's like they – I think they blew the entire special effects budget on that one scene.
And it's a fun scene. Again, very fun scene. Although, I don't know why running fast means you can tuck a human person under each arm and run with them. that seems like it would be very heavy and difficult to do. Or just throw a person like they weigh nothing. I don't know how running fast.
I think that actually kind of might work in some ways. You know, that like if you're swinging a golf club fast enough at something, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's probably some kind of physics reasons why it might make sense.
Okay, I'll buy it because it's fun. Like, the way it happens is fun, and it's a well-executed scene. And this is an example of how a scene with really excellent special effects, I would argue.
Yeah, it was really special, like very good special effects. If you, by the way, if you do major in physics, can you please explain to us if the Quicksilver stuff has some basis in reality? I would be interested to know.
I don't think it does.
Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. I also want to say that the Quicksilver stuff, I love the music integration as well.
Yes. But again, greatest hits. It's like I saw this once before. Okay, it's still fun. I'm still enjoying it. But
yeah. They didn't do anything new with the character, really.
No.
He comes back at the end to do an emotional tie-in with Eric Lencher, but
yes,
not really. I just love the conception and execution of that character, Jeff, because it's not just a dude that can move fast. It is a dude that perceives time differently than everyone else. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah,
and I think just that's just really impressive the way they do it. So
yeah, and I thought the last bit where he's like kind of kicking the shit out of Apocalypse, and then Apocalypse is just sort of like, I'll figure this out.
Yeah, I can telekinesis my way out of this mess.
Yeah, he's like, I just got to like slow it down and see where he's gonna be.
Yeah,
hang on a second, I'll get it. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, that was cool.
I loved the scene where. I mean, I thought all the stuff at the beginning was pretty good. I like the scene where Magneto takes down an entire army with, you know, a locket.
Okay, this is one of the the consistent elements of this series that I'm a fan of, is the idea that Magneto is one of the most powerful mutants.
Yeah.
And you really get a sense of why he's the most powerful, because with one piece of metal, he can lay waste to an entire army of dudes.
Right. And that's kind of like when he was in that jail and those guys – he had tiny little bits of lead that he pulled out, and then he killed everybody with those little beads of lead, you know, back when he was Ian McKellen.
Yeah. But he had arguably less metal than that in this scene. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it was more poignant that he killed it with his little daughter's locket.
You're right about the greatest hits thing, though, Jeff. The question is, how many more times can we see a sequence of events whereby Magneto has some humanity, loses it, and then gains it back again by the end of the film?
Yes, that is the question. And and while doing that, is hovering in the air as little bits of shit are flying around him. That, to me, honestly, is the biggest thing I need to veto in any future X-Men movie. Like, there's nothing less compelling to me than Magneto sort of just chilling out in some sort of meditative state.
Yeah, like, what is he doing? You know,
his power has been amplified, so now he's all over the world deconstructing shit for some reason. But like, what is his? The thing that they don't ever really make clear is that Apocalypse doesn't, at least they don't explicitly say that he has any kind of mind control abilities. He just presents like a compelling argument to people. You know, he like waltzes in and asks Psylocke to join him, and then asks Archangel to join him, and asks Storm to join him. He just kind of like goes, "Hey guys, you want to be on the winning side? You know, want to be one of the cool kids?" And they're all sort of down for it. He's not like coercing them into it, right? And so, like, what is Eric? Eric's pissed off because his family got killed, and he just wants to see the world burn. He just wants to destroy everything.
Yeah.
So his whole deal with Apocalypse is, thanks for the bonus to my power, now I get to destroy everything.
Yes. That's you just hit it right on the head, Jeff. I don't understand what's confusing.
I do. But, like, what's – then what? You know what I mean? Like, then what? Now that the world is dead. Okay? Like
– well, they can rule over the debris, Jeff. Well,
I guess. I mean,
it was odd to see Eric in a normal life, because I think through most of the films in general, we see him trying to kill someone. Like, he's trying to exact revenge in almost every single film that we see him in, right?
Yes.
So,
you know, I thought that was cool. I thought that was really neat. Although he's sort of living in the 1890s with his family that you're rooting for, and yet he's got like this kid in the 80s playing Pac-Man in his other kid. It's like he's a deadbeat dad, and we're sort of still rooting for him to hide away and be, I don't know.
Yeah. Why doesn't he get together with a kid who's in America? Oh, wait. Actually, it's because he's a wanted criminal there.
Oh, yeah. There's that.
But I did think the scene when he killed all those dudes was really effective.
Right.
But it's like we talked about, man, how many times do we need to see Eric Lyncher suffer a horrifying loss in these films? Right.
Right.
I don't know that I can take it anymore. I don't know that, because it's very painful. Michael Fassbender is a very good actor, you see.
right. And he literally gets to destroy Auschwitz. We literally see the Auschwitz get destroyed in this movie.
One thing that I did like about this film was how it did refer back to X-Men First Class and the other X-Men films, right?
I think Bryan Singer is really proud of that opening sequence from the first X-Men movie, because haven't we seen flashbacks to Eric's the Auschwitz scene from the very first movie like three or four times now?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or at least it feels that way. But, I mean, Jeff, that movie scene did set the tone for a lot of superhero films that would follow. It grounded the fantastical in reality and in horrifying reality, too.
Yeah.
And
it's a good scene.
It's a great, effective scene, and it showed, like, hey, this is not the kind of campy, cheesy comic book superhero films that we've seen in the past. This is something different. We're going to make you feel something when you watch these movies.
Right.
And so I liked all the references back to the old stuff because it made it feel like it's all connected. And in general, I think it worked. I think you really get a sense, man, they really have built something pretty amazing. And there have been some highs and lows. You know, there's been some really good films and some really awful films. But overall, it's pretty impressive what they've been able to accomplish.
Yeah, for the number of characters that they're juggling and all the different stuff that's happened, I think that, like you said, I think this is a solid movie. I think this is sort of right in the middle of the pack. I would put it closer to the good side than the bad side because the bad side is so low in this particular series, and this is pretty. You know, watchable movie. It's just not anything particularly special, and that's my only gripe. Is that it's fine. But comparing it to Civil War, for example, and what the mainline Marvel Studios movies are doing, just sort of average Marvel Studios movies. I don't have as much fun in this series as I do in any of those movies, really.
Yeah, I mean, I was just talking with my friend who I saw the film with about how if this had been released in a world where there was no DC and there was no Marvel, we'd probably be saying, wow, that was amazing, you know?
Yeah, but, no, I that's kind of what I was referencing earlier when I feel like it's almost sad that just the magic of having these characters faithfully represented on screen is gone, and now that's not enough anymore, you know, and that makes me a little bit sad because there was a time when this would be unheard of to have this kind of, you know, representation of the X-Men in a movie. And yet now I just feel like, well, it's not really great. It's just merely good. And, you know, for so much of my youth, there was no such thing as a good superhero movie.
Right. Burnetsky 9292 in the chat room points out the scene in the film when Eric screams at the sky, "Is this what I am? Is this what you want?" That's my reinterpretation of Michael Fassbender's performance.
Well done. Yeah, bravo.
Thank you. And I do think Burnetsky points out a pretty solid point there, which is a lot of the dialogue in this film is pretty cringeworthy. You know, some of it's pretty rough. There's a scene in the helicopter when Jean Grey is talking with Cyclops, and Jean Grey's like, "Your brother thought, you know, you would make a difference in the world, maybe even change the world." And he says, like, "How do you know what my brother thought?" "Oh, really? The person, you already know she's a psychic?"
Yeah, exactly.
And then she's like, "I know what everybody thinks." It's like, oh, come on. That's just kind of the dialogue. The story itself, overall, I thought was pretty good, with the exception of the villain. And I got to say this, Jeff. And I want to hear what you think about this. This makes me really scared how they're going to handle Thanos in the Marvel Universe, right? Like,
yeah,
he's under layers of makeup. It's a dude who's, you know, Thanos is purple, I think, not blue.
Right.
But it's a very well-respected actor under these layers of makeup who's theoretically all-powerful, who has indeterminate powers. Like, what do you think they're going to do? Like, how can they execute Thanos well? Especially because up until now, Thanos in the Marvel Universe hasn't been particularly compelling.
I'm hoping that they really double down on his sort of love affair with Death, with Lady Death. I think that would be a really interesting concept, and it's an interesting concept in the comics, and it kind of humanizes him in an odd way. But it is a challenge, and I think anytime you get to this sort of galactic level, the cosmic side of the Marvel Universe, it does have that blue light in the sky problem where it just stuff becomes
abstract.
Really
unspecific,
abstract. Yes, it just becomes energy and power and people going, "Oh!" You know, it's like it's not relatable, and it I don't think translates as well to the big screen as, you know, something on along the scale of a Civil War where, you know, these human beings are passionately fighting for what they believe in.
Yeah, but you're – again, I don't even think you're pointing to a problem in the execution of this film so much as the inherent storyline of the film.
Yeah.
Right? And yes. when you have powers this big, it can be difficult to make it feel relevant. And it can be difficult to visually represent them, too. Right. You know, at the end of the film, it's a pretty silly scene, I thought, where a giant Apocalypse is fighting little James McAvoy in the Xavier house.
Right, in his mind. In
his
mind,
right. And yeah. So that's their way of visually representing what's going on in their minds.
Right.
I thought it looked pretty silly. I don't think it really worked for me, but I appreciated that, man, that is difficult to do. Like, you know, if you asked me to come up with a solution of how to represent these two people fighting in a way that's compelling, it would be very challenging for me to come up with something. And so, hey, having them kind of have a really actual physical fist fight, that's as good as any other way. I mean, when you think of other ways of doing it, it's like I think of like Dark City, you know, the end of Dark City where there's the two guys with the mental powers and there's just like waves of mental powers going at each other, you know?
Right.
Like, that's not super compelling either. So there's just – it's tough, man. It is tough to come up with an interesting way of representing it, and I don't envy them. And so I don't really fault them for it not coming across super well at the end there. So
yeah, I think I actually kind of dug that. I thought that was clever and fun, and I thought a lot of that ending sequence really worked. My biggest problem is the basic setting of all around the world there are structures being sort of broken down to their component parts by Magneto, who's in a meditative state, just doing that. And it's like that I don't think that's particularly interesting. It's just not interesting. It's like it's such a vague end of the world threat that they literally have to cut to a scene of government officials in a room going, we're all going to die, or oh thank God we all thank you Mr. President,
our prayers were answered.
We're like, what is that? It's such an awkward, clumsy way to convey that. And I wish that wasn't the way it was.
Yeah. Going back further in time in the movie, I think that there were some really interesting concepts introduced towards the beginning of the film. Like seeing the Cyclops origin story. I've always wondered what that's like. You know, how did he develop his powers? And when he first started shooting lasers out of his eyes, what were the social implications of that? Like, how did he survive?
He did a good job of making that manifest itself without him murdering anybody.
Yes.
It was pretty well done.
My friend who I was with asked the question, in the opening scene, he shoots his lasers at a bathroom door. And the kid behind it survives, but then later on he's melting like gigantic, you know, army grade metal vaults with his thing. And how does that all work? And my answer to that is, hey, his skills were still developing in the opening scenes, right? Maybe they weren't quite as strong or refined or consistent as they were later on in the film.
And also, shut up. That's the answer to that question.
But Jeff, because you've never nitpicked one of these films in your whole life.
No, it
does remind me of like how bad some of the special effects were. Like when he like shoots open that tree and the tree falls to the ground,
it just looked bad.
And the opening scene with Apocalypse and these gigantic stone slabs sliding down this ramp at 100 miles per hour, it was terrible. I did not believe it for a second. Anyway, sorry, Jeff.
I thought the sequence with the German ring fighting with Angel and Nightcrawler was really well done, and it really looked like those wings were practical, which I give them credit for. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean the special effects were very inconsistent throughout the film. You know, sometimes they were great, and sometimes they were horrible. And that was one of the scenes where they were great. It's freaking X-Men cage fight directed by Baz Luhrmann. And it was awesome. The question for me is, how did they even get the mutants into the cage? Because I would think that would be a complicated and tall order. But whatever, we try not to think too much about that.
I want to talk a little bit about something you brought up earlier about Psylocke and how misused she is, or just sort of underused and really – she doesn't belong in this movie at all. Like it really just feels like we're throwing this character in this movie because it's a character that we own the rights to and we can, it looks cool and we know it can be cool and let's do it. Rather than giving the character anything worthwhile to do whatsoever. And I think that's a shame because Psylocke's a really interesting character. And it, one thing in particular didn't make any sense to me. You know, we have this sequence where Apocalypse is going around and collecting his four horsemen. And every time he finds a new one, he sort of turns them up to 11, gives them a boost to their power. And they have a physical metamorphosis.
Right.
They evolve in some way, right? And in the comics, you have that exact thing that happened to Psylocke. Like, she started out as Betsy Braddock, the Psylocke being this, you know, psychic, but she was a very sort of conservatively dressed. She had this kind of billowy costume. She didn't really do anything badass. And then, like in the early 90s, she got a redesign, and there was this metamorphosis. She went and she turned into like the, you know, she had the Psy swords on her hands, and she turned into this like ninja character. So you have that opportunity, like based in the comics, to throw another cool reference to people like me that know that stuff, and start her out being something very different from what Apocalypse turns her into. And they just completely don't do that. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, they made her wear less clothing to indicate
right.
the metamorphosis.
But there's
that was,
no
that was about
everybody
the
else gets really cool
yeah,
changes to
like
their
metal
powers.
Wings and Eric Lyncher gets his whole suit back and Storm.
By the way, I love the fact there's literally a scene where there's literally in this movie a scene where Magneto gets like a psychic phone call and like walks into another room and takes the phone call, and in the background of the entire scene, Apocalypse is like designing costumes.
Awesome.
He's literally like costume designing.
He's like, I want your face to look like this, and
it's
let's
hilarious.
Have the line going
like,
here.
He's literally like changing the shoulder of a costume. Like, oh yeah, I really dig that. That looks so sweet. And like, and Magneto gets a phone call and like moves over to the other side of the room. It's great.
It is pretty silly.
Yeah,
pretty silly. But I agree. Psylocke is wasted. Although at the end of the film, she does get to stare ominously at our main characters as she walks away engulfed in flames. And
yeah.
We have a feeling that she might be coming back for a feature film, Jeffrey.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Don't count her out.
Yep. Don't count her out. Try to count her at all. I appreciated what they tried to do with the final scene in terms of the fight choreography. You know, they split the X-Men up. I almost said they split the Avengers up. They split the X-Men up according to people whose abilities roughly might match each other.
Yeah.
And that was kind of cool, you know, but you compare that to the airport scene from Civil War, and I just thought that the latter was far better executed.
No comparison.
Grander in scope, and the special effects just look better. The abilities, you know, they put a lot of thought into how would these abilities interact with each other and where these people would be located in space near each other. So,
yeah, I mean, that airport sequence in Civil War is wildly entertaining. You're laughing and cheering and thrilled and amazed by the cleverness of what's going on. What happens at the end of this movie is everybody shoots their energy beams at the guy, and his energy beams are blocking their energy beams until the lady with the biggest energy beams stops preventing her energy beams from coming out of her, and then the biggest energy beams get the guy. You know, it's a little different.
Yeah.
You know?
And then at the end, Magneto throws down these steel beams in front of the dude in an X formation.
Yeah.
You know, rather than throw them into the dude. Throw them in front of the dude. Block that guy.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Block that guy.
We joke because we love. I mean, overall, you're describing it in very negative terms, but
am I? I'm the one. I feel like I liked it even more than you did. I really am shocked that people are hating on this movie because it's not bad.
Exactly. That's my feeling. It's not horrible coming out of it.
Yeah.
And I know that doesn't sound like high praise, but based on the reviews I've seen,
right.
It is high praise, you know. So any other thoughts, Jeff? Any other topics we wish to discuss about this?
Oh, man. What did you think of the total rip on X3 in the context of the movie, walking out of Return of the Jedi and saying, you know, the third ones are always terrible.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was very clever, and I'm surprised that Fox let them get it in there. But I guess Bryan Singer has earned enough credit with X-Men Days of Future Past. And the movie did very well. And for those who don't know the backstory, they got completely screwed out of the story they wanted to tell for X3. You know, Brett Ratner directed it, but I don't even think it was Brett Ratner's fault that that movie wasn't very good. It felt to me, without knowing the full extent of the facts, it felt to me like the result of a bunch of studio meddling that resulted in a movie that was pretty bad and overstuffed and bloated. So then, you know, Bryan Singer left the series, came back, and did a pretty good job with that film, X-Men Days of Future Past. And then now this one, he's done a decent job as well. So it was a nice little jab at X3, I think. I mean, arguably, Jeff, it was a self-deprecating jab because this is technically the third film that features the young X-Men. Right?
That's a good point, too. Yeah.
So maybe he was saying, like, this movie is not going to be good, which in some ways is true. but in other ways, it's actually pretty entertaining. I had a decent – I was never bored. I had a decent time. And
although I have to say the kid next to me, it was a packed theater, as I said, packed. No buffer seats to be found in the entire place. And there was a kid sitting next to me who, I don't know, was probably 18. And halfway through the movie, he started meticulously removing the wrapper from his bottle of water. Like, full attention on the wrapper and getting it off of the bottle. And I felt like asking him if he just completely lost interest in this movie.
You should have just asked him straight up.
Yeah, I was like, are you just done? Are you just done watching this? And I was very surprised. But the guy behind me, who leapt from his chair when Jean Grey unleashed the Phoenix Force, he leapt from his chair going, yes! Yes! He, I think, was less interested in his water bottle.
I think overall, my problem with this film is it proves that sometimes more is less.
Yeah.
You know, and what I mean by that is, you know, more characters, more powers, more scope, more stakes. You compare the opening scene of this film with the opening of X2, which takes place in one building and there's only maybe 10 characters or 10, you know, actual actors or stunt doubles in that scene where Nightcrawler is invading the White House. And man, that is still one of the best opening action scenes of any comic book movie, in my opinion. I mean, just really well executed. And we had never seen the Nightcrawler transportation effect prior to that, and certainly hadn't seen it rendered that well, anything like that effectively on screen until that point. And so I just really love that scene. And you compare that scene with the opening scene of this film, which has 1,000 people, you know, and it's on this huge grand scale and horrible CG. And the difference could not be more stark.
Yeah.
And so sometimes more is less. And this series has ballooned beyond control. And I think overall it wasn't bad. There was a lot of great things, great performances. But if they want to make a good X-Men film, I think they've really got to scale it down in terms of the ambitions.
I've always felt like the missed opportunity in re-examining the origins of the first team, you know, first class, which is really the comic book that they did a few years ago called X-Men First Class, did this, which was, you know, examine that original team in the comics, which was Cyclops, Ms. Marvel, Iceman, Beast, Angel. That was the team, right? And in those days, it really felt to me, and maybe I'm misremembering this, but it really felt to me like those were the only students. You know, every time we visit Xavier's school, it's like teeming with hundreds of kids, it seems like, or at least dozens of kids, right? And I always felt like it would be much more interesting if Xavier's school had like 5 kids and it was his only class. Like, he taught a class and it was these kids, and that was the entire makeup of the school for a few years, because that was the first team of kids, and That was all he had the resources to be able to teach, and he had like hands on with each of these kids very intensely.
Yeah.
And I just think that would be much more interesting to sort of, as you say, reduce the scale and make it a very personal story about a very small team that lays the groundwork for him being able to go all across the world and collect mutants, you know, with, of course, Cerebro, which is very integral to the whole storytelling of the X-Men story.
I haven't gone that far in terms of imagining what might make for a better film, but I will say that every time I see Xavier's School for Gifted Youngsters on screen, the more I see it on screen, the less sense it makes to me as a concept. That you would put all these kids, many of them prepubescent, in this one school where their powers, they can't even control them. You know,
right.
These people are like, these kids are living WMDs that could go off at any moment. Teenage years, adolescence, it's not the most stable time in a person's life.
No.
You know, and you're packing them all into this small space. Just feels like a lot of things could
go wrong. That's the way I always interpreted it. And again, I can be corrected because it's been a long time since I read those early stories. But the way I always interpreted it was that the school was a front for this like super team that he was putting together that was going to go around the world and actively intervene when mutants were in danger. They were going to save kids. But the school is a school, but it's also a front so that they can have these kids there to turn them into basically a SWAT team to go in and protect a oppressed group of people, right? So it wasn't always about Xavier like founding a school and being a professor. It was about him creating this front for an awesome badass team. And I think that makes more sense if it's like five kids, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know that the front plotline ever really was conveyed in the film series.
Right.
Do you feel like it was?
Not at all.
Yeah.
No, it was always like he's creating this school, which is sort of how it morphed in, what it morphed into in the comics. And maybe it always was. Maybe, again, I'm misremembering. But the sense I had as a kid reading all those stories was that the school wasn't – it wasn't about being a school. It was about – that was the secret identity of – the badass super team called the X-Men. Like their secret identity was they were just kids at a school.
Right. That's interesting. And yeah, and then in the earlier X-Men films, we see some of the grown-up X-Men team members teaching classes and stuff.
Which is where we got – like that's the thing about starting the films, you know, 40 years into X-Men storytelling is because that's where the comics got to, right?
Right.
But that first class idea when Stan Lee – you know, his first writing X-Men stories, it was Professor Xavier and his five students who were, saving the world.
Here's my question for you, Jeff. Do you wish there was an X-Men Apocalypse Jubilee cut? You know what I'm talking about?
The Jubilee cut was like showing more of the students. Was that from the other movies?
No, I'm referring to the fact that there was a Rogue cut or a Rogue edition. Like they left out Rogue's whole thing. And apparently there was more Jubilee that was not included in this film.
She does have the most authentic costume in the entire
cinematic
universe. She has
the costume that is closest to the original costume. And it is also very 80s. Like, if she had that costume in present day, I don't think it would make as much sense.
Right. Well, that's because the character was invented in the 80s.
Yeah, so it kind of was like, oh, man, wow, the 80s choice to make the movie then is really paying off for them.
We never get to see Jubilee do any Jubilee stuff, though.
Yeah. Big disappointment. So, all right. Any other thoughts, Jeff?
No. I'm curious to hear what Devendra thinks because So much hate for this movie, and I don't understand it.
I'll bet money. I'm going to call it right now that he loved it. That's what I'm going to call it.
Okay, that's good.
I predicted.
I heard from friends that were saying it makes Batman v Superman look like a great movie, and I do not agree with that at all.
I agree.
I still think Batman v Superman is much worse than this movie.
Yeah. Oh, you know, one other thing I wanted to mention. I don't understand the decision to make it so that Moira MacTaggert didn't have any of her memories. Although I guess that decision was made in a previous film. So
that's correct. Yeah,
it wasn't like they did it they just came up with it in this film. They came up, right. They did that in X-Men First Class, right? Yes. But the reveal at the end when so I think I don't like that because it removes a lot of agency from her in this movie. You know, she's just basically fumbling around the whole time.
Yeah, she doesn't have much function in this movie until the end, that's for sure.
And then there's this big reveal at the end where he gives her the memories back, and I can see how that would have been effective in a completely different film. You know, like if it was not X-Men Apocalypse, if it was X-Men something else, I can see how that moment would have been actually pretty moving. Mm-hmm. But because this movie just tried to do too many things, didn't really land that well.
I would agree with that. Yeah.
I will say this movie did a decent job of juggling all these different characters and trying to give them all a little bit of time. And, you know,
it's funny how like all the same people that we've already seen be horrible are still like Colonel Stryker. It's like, is he the only guy on the entire planet that just has a hard on for getting mutants? Like, you know, we've already seen him die. We see him not be a problem at some point. Although, is that the same timeline? I don't know. All of it feels so strange. Like the Moyer McTaggart moment where it's like, oh, you have a son? Yeah, we remember that her son fucks everybody up for a while, but does he in this timeline? I don't know.
Who's Moira McTaggart's son?
It is what is his name? It begins with a P. He can manipulate time. What's his name? Somebody in the chat room knows. It's because of the P.
Proteus?
Proteus. Yeah, Proteus.
Anyway, I think that's going to bring us into this review. Overall, not a bad film. We spent a lot of time picking on it because there were a lot of problems with it. But
yeah.
I enjoyed myself.
I did too.
And I think the villain character is pretty bad. And that's like the biggest weakness. Mm-hmm. I think if they had chosen a different villain and a different central conflict and left everything else the same, like all the characters we know and love going through many of the same things, I think it would have been a much better film.
Yeah.
But
actually, they could have called this X-Men versus the Mummy.
What?
They could have rebooted. This is like a Mummy reboot and an X-Men reboot all at the same time.
Oh, because it takes place in Egypt and all that stuff.
Well, doesn't he like have the same powers as the Mummy? I don't know the Mummy movies very well, but I feel like the Mummy movies is like everything turns to sand and I have the power of sand and everything I do can mess you up with sand.
It's not quite like this, Jeff. That's all I'll say. That's all I'll say. Anyway, well, that's all for now on the Slash Filmcast. Thanks for tuning in. Stay tuned to hear what we'll be reviewing next week. In the meantime, Jeff Cannata, where can we find more of your work on the internet?
Well, I have several other shows you can listen to. In fact, if you want to check out me on video, why not check out a show called Tomorrow Daily on CNET? We got some fun stuff. We had a really fun episode today with a stand-up comic on the show. You can find that at tomorrowdaily.com. I do a video game show called DLC. You can find that at 5by5.tv/DLC. And I also do a comedy science show with Anthony Carboni called We Have Concerns. It's only 20-minute episodes. They're pretty fun. You can find that at wehaveconcerns.com.
Find all my stuff at davechen.me and find my film, The Primary Instinct, at theprimaryinstinct.com or on Hulu right now if you're in the U.S. and subscribe to Hulu. Check it out there. And next week, we are going to review Popstar, Never Stop, Never Stopping. New universal comedy directed by Akiva Schaffer and Jorma Taccone and starring Andy Samberg.
Man, I want that to be good. I hope it's funny.
Let's hope
really
so. Let's hope so. Thanks for tuning into the official podcast of SlashFilm.com. We're out. They watch the movies, flicks, tracks for the good, slide back. It's the Slash Filmcast. For all the news and the movies coming out, because you know that it's the thing worth talking about.